Hey, all my uncomfortable friends, you've heard me talking about the Eufy Video Lock for some time now, and I gotta tell you, this thing is a game changer. Smart lock, security camera, and doorbell, all in one unit, and all it took was a Phillips screwdriver to install it. The Eufy Video Lock, that's E-U-F-Y, Video Lock allows for unlocking the door three different ways: through fingerprint technology, passcode entry, or physical keys. The crystal clear 2K video is instantly accessible with no monitoring or monthly subscription needed. It even has two-way audio when you use the free Wi-Fi driven iOS or Android compatible Eufy Video Lock app. I have a brick home, and there was no way I was going to drill through the brick and hardwire any of the other options out there just for the sake of having a video doorbell. But with the Eufy Video Lock, simply replacing the deadbolt on your front door and operating on a rechargeable battery that lasts up to 4 months, that was the perfect choice for me. With the Eufy Video Lock, you get an incredible 18-month warranty and 24/7 customer service. Search Eufy Video Lock, that's E-U-F-Y, Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/video lock to take complete control of your entry doors now.
Doing that, I was face to face with it. It was holding me by my throat, and it felt like it was sucking something out of me.
I probably should have been more scared than I was when I witnessed the exorcism.
I turned and looked on my right side. When I did, there's a beam on the side of the tree, a large beam. It's looking at me and I'm looking at it.
After I hit the lock button and looked back up, I saw red eyes staring back at me.
That they're going to show multiple gods all over the earth, be able to speak in people's languages. And at that point, it kind of converged into this one entity, which will be revealed as extraterrestrial. You'll realize that aliens are the gods of old, and at that point it'll wipe religion out of the context of humanity.
No, it couldn't have been a person, I know that. I know that people can't run through the woods like that.
So this thing comes into view, and I see it. It's 50 yards away from me. It's walking on two legs. It's huge. This is a big, hairy looking being.
Welcome. I'm your host, and this is Uncomfortable. Of the Dewey Lake / Sister Lakes monster sightings of 1964. These events took place in Dowagiac, Michigan. The reports quickly gained national attention and turned the sleepy little lake rental community into a monster hunter's haven. Some 57 years later, the impact of these sightings could be seen everywhere and are still embraced by the community. Our vision is set to be an informative and event-packed gathering of Bigfoot discovery. This day-long event will feature speakers, presentations, and special guests all on site to provide attendees with information on many different aspects of these elusive cryptid beings. This event will be an opportunity for fans of the Uncomfortable podcast to mingle with many of the guests who have appeared on our episodes, related to the Bigfoot phenomenon. Sister Lakes Brewing is the site for this event. We applaud their partnership in hosting this convention. We encourage you to enjoy the amazing menu of cryptid food offerings. And remember, this is the only place that you can enjoy Dewey Lake Monster IPA. All of the information is available at our website, www.bigfootandbrews.com. Get your tickets early. Stay for the day. Enjoy our lineup of speakers, which includes Mr. Ron Moorhead, Mr. James Lady, Mr. Val Zalvala, and John, the main subject of my second and third episodes of Opening Day. This will be the first time anywhere that John has come out publicly and talked about his experiences on that fateful day. Rumor is abounding that Bodine the Bigfoot will also be in attendance. So bring your cameras and a steady hand. We wouldn't want you walking away with any blurry pictures. So why this Dewey Lake monster? Sometimes known as the Sister Lakes monster. What's the big deal? Why Dowagiac, Michigan? Well, to be honest with you, if you do any amount of investigation into these sightings, you'll find that it wasn't just a one-off thing. When you start digging into it, what you'll find is a series of reports that happened during the summer of 1964. And in those reports, the descriptions of this creature that was seen is very much in lines with what we know as Bigfoot or Sasquatch. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's guest, back for her second appearance on the show. You may know her from episode 27 back in August of last year. She's a psychic medium, a remote viewer, and she is a member of Project Psi, a team of psychic and forensic remote viewers who are responsible for rescuing missing children, shutting down human trafficking rings, and closing cold case murders. To date, they've rescued 472 children, closed 18 cold case murders, and assisted in shutting down 11 human trafficking rings. She started to notice her paranormal experiences at about age 4. As she grew, her passion for one of the haunted locations afforded her the opportunity to appear and consult in Chris Holton's Haunted Earth paradocumentary, A Haunting at Bachelor's Grove. Now, I have some experience with Bachelor's Grove, and as many of the experiences that I've had in my life, I will not talk about my experience with Bachelor's Grove, at least on air. She's a member of MUFON. She does CE5. She's an experiencer. She served as a consultant for Thomas Cromwell's books, They Are Here, Central U.S. UFOs, and Earthquakes and UFOs. She is an international author of several books, including the one we're going to be talking about tonight, Dimensions, Mysterious Triangles of the U.S. She's co-authored digging into Skinwalker Ranch and Skinwalker Ranch The Basin Files. In addition, she is a freelance journalist writing for ChicagoHauntings.com, Paranormal Underground Magazine, iHeart Magazine, and Mind, Body, and Spirit Guide. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to Uncomfortable, Miss Cheryl Lynn Carter. Hi, Cheryl. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you. Thanks so much for being back on the show.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
I think in our last episode back in August of last year, we threatened that there would be a revisiting of our conversation. So we're going to get back at it.
Good. And
first of all, the book, Dimensions, Mysterious Triangles of the U.S., fantastic. I love it. For the listeners out there, I have a autographed copy in my hands that Cheryl got out to me. One of the gateway drugs for me when in my youth was obviously the UFOs, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, and the Bermuda Triangle. Those were the ones that I weaned my baby teeth on, so to speak. But now we're going to get to talk to Cheryl about there's a good number of these triangles that show up throughout the U.S. And in fact, throughout the world, there are multiple triangles, but we're going to focus on the ones that she's highlighted in her book that happened in the U.S. Now, I asked you to cover two specifically for me and then pick one of your choice. And I asked to cover Michigan because of the obvious that we're both very centrally located to that area and the Great Lakes. And then I asked you to cover what's been going on up in Alaska. And that for me is that's such a mysterious area. It's such a vast area that is so underpopulated by the size of it that so many interesting things going on up there. Which one do you want to start off with?
Oh, let's do Michigan because we love our Michigan.
All right. Yes, we do. Let's get into Michigan. By the way, I wanted to say real quickly, a lovely foreword in the book from our friend Bill Konkleski, the state director of MUFON in Michigan. That was a very nice very nice foreword he put there in your book.
Yes. I'm honored that he wrote that for me.
So let's get into it. Let's start talking about the weirdness of the Michigan Triangle. Now, the Michigan Triangle starts up in Ludington and works its way down to just about 35, 40 minutes away from me in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and then goes across the lake over to Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Yes.
And what's been going on in that triangle?
Well, so many mysteries. You know, people think the Bermuda Triangle has the most disappearances of ships, but Michigan has way more planes, ships, people all missing. Tons and tons more.
Really?
I mean, the first recorded things happening was like in 1881.
So that's going back quite a ways.
Well, I'm sure it went back long before people were keeping records of this stuff.
Right.
Because there were lots of fishermen and sailors that kind of avoided the place. So they always knew that something wasn't quite right and they didn't want to get involved in it. Yes, so in 1881, there was the St. Albans steamer. And something happened one day, and they were forced to abandon the ship near Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then that was in January, and then in February, all of a sudden, people started seeing a ghostly steamship, that was their ship, with smoke coming out of the stacks.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And 1883, the Mary McLean tugboat was out, and all of a sudden, there was a barrage of large chunks of ice, almost the size of bricks, that were falling into the ship for about 30 minutes.
I do remember reading about that.
It was bizarre, but that could just be nature, but it's still very bizarre.
I don't recall any time having watched the news where they, instead of calling for hail, that they're calling for blocks of ice to fall from the sky.
Not that big, yeah. Yeah. And then in 1891, the Thomas Hume schooner was out on the lake, and it disappeared with its entire crew of eight. And in 2006, it was discovered. And it was still in perfect condition, but they never found any trace of any of the people that were on the ship.
Oh, really?
Or, you know, or any indication that it crashed, anything was wrong with it. It was just fine.
You know, now from... I'm not an expert angler by any stretch of the imagination, but I do enjoy fishing, and I have spent a decent amount of time on Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. And weather can play a factor.
Oh, sure.
In an instant. I have been out, you know, a mile and a half. Beautiful day, hardly any wind, barely a ripple to the water. And within minutes, with a weather system moving in, you're holding on to the sides and hoping and praying like hell that you make it back to land. So, mm-hmm. you know, weather can definitely play a big part in the loss of vessels. But there's some weird stuff that is... Much harder to just explain away with weather being a factor for it. Let's get into some of those.
Okay. 1937, the O.M. McFarlane freighter was heading up to Wisconsin, and Captain George Donner was manning the ship. And he took care of everything until they got through the one passage where it was kind of icy, and he says, okay, everything is safe now. He goes, I'm going to go to my cabin, take a nap, call me when we reach Port Washington. So at 6 p.m., they knock on the door to let him know they were almost there, and there was no answer. They kept knocking, no answer, and the door was locked. So they got the door open, and they went into his cabin, and he wasn't there. He had just disappeared off the ship. And they never found him.
Really?
Yeah. Now, that's not weather related.
No, definitely not.
And nobody saw anything strange happening. He just was gone.
Now, one of my favorite things that, and this is more of an interest than anything really weird, more of an archaeological interest, I guess. The miniature Stonehenge that's in Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I first started hearing about it, I thought it was just a bunch of BS. But it's not. It is literally a real thing. And from what I'm understanding, the location of it is pretty much kept secret because they don't want anybody going down there and messing with the site. Am I correct?
Right.
But there's a stone down there that has a carving of a mammoth.
Yeah.
And I believe one of my other guests, Chetan Noir, I think is the one that relayed to me that was a, like a killing circle where they would basically herd a mammoth into that area.
Right.
And it was like a stone cage where it would not be able to get out. And then several of the tribesmen will.
You know. And people are just, you know, they just go, oh, why is this under the water? Well, look how many ice ages we had. And I'm pretty sure that was land at one time. And it got flooded when the ice melted.
Obviously.
So it's not really a mystery that it's down on the bottom of the lake. We find this a lot where there's all kinds of, all over the world, all kinds of structures under the water that wasn't water before it was land.
Right. So back to the weirder stuff that's happened. One of the stories that really, really gets me, and I guess once we talk about this, we'll get into like what's actually going on with that triangular area, if it's ley lines or weird magnetic anomalies or what you've discovered. But back in 1978, a gentleman by the name of Stephen Kubacki, a 23-year-old student from Hope College in Holland, Michigan, was on a cross-country ski trip near Saugatuck, which is about an hour north of me. Disappeared while he was on the ski trip. Next day, snowmobilers found his equipment basically abandoned, and police seem to have thought that they found his footprints somewhere on the ice, tracked it for a while, and they abruptly came to an end. And for all intents and purposes, the police that were investigating thought that he had fallen through the ice and had perished of hypothermia or drowning.
Hmm.
1979, May of 1979, Kubacki shows back up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, 15 months after disappearing, and reports that he just found himself laying in the grass over 700 miles away.
With
no memory of what had happened, no memory of the previous year and a half, or he was apparently wearing clothes that were unfamiliar to him.
Oh my gosh.
And that his backpack had contained some random maps that he was unaware of, and he basically had been left to believe that he had been traveling, but has no idea, no memory of it whatsoever.
Does he remember where he started out, or that he can't remember that either?
I'm sorry, say again.
Does he remember where he started out with the first day before he disappeared? Does he remember that?
He remembers nothing from the 15 months where he was missing. So, you know, based on where he disappeared, it seemed to suggest that, you know, Saugatuck being right smack dab in the eastern side of the Michigan Triangle, that, you know, unless he had a random attack of amnesia or anything else, something very unusual happened to this gentleman. And, you know, whether that be a alien abduction or he went into some kind of a dimensional portal or
went through another dimension and came out on the other side.
That's always just been one of the stories that kind of stuck out, as far as, you know, almost falling in lines with like the missing 411 stuff.
Right.
You know, but for him to have no memory of it and basically have amnesia or has had his memory wiped, that's one of the more unusual stories. And it seems to be fairly persistent when you doing, you know, some research on this the subject of the Michigan Triangle. So from you, I guess, you know, what do you think's going on there? I mean, I know you study the ley lines and the different grids that fall across the world. What's going on in that area in Lake Michigan? What are the...
Well, I mean, there could, you know, people just think it's the water. You got the land there, you know, close to the water, like him, you know, something strange could happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there could be different dimensions, portals open, who knows? Who knows what's causing, this on this lake? Doesn't mean it can't also pertain to the surrounding land. Mm.
Are there ley lines that fall across that area?
I don't know for sure. Possibly.
It's unusual for sure. I mean, obviously, it's a very large body of water.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's highly traveled. I mean, there's shipping routes and, you know, you've got people on there using it for pleasure boating, and you have, you know, different towns have tours and cityscape tours where you can jump on, have dinner, and look at the Chicago skyline and stuff like that. I'm sure that's
what I mean. Lake Michigan is in Chicago too. People don't realize that, you know.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of weird things happening in Chicago along Lake Michigan also.
Now, what about UFOs in the Triangle? And the reason I ask is because I have a friend of mine who was at Grand Mere Beach. Mm-hmm. And this was several years ago, but he and I had started a conversation about some of this weird stuff that I like to delve into. And at first he kind of had a grin on his face, like he thought I was nuts for talking about it. But then as we progressed to talk, he and some friends had been at the beach, were there in the evening time, and facing Chicago, facing due west, they basically saw a couple of lights that were extremely bright and way off in the distance, but lower to the horizon. And as they kept watching them, they made it across the lake and over their heads at a very, very rapid speed. And he said it wasn't very long afterwards that there were two, if not three, what he assumed would have been military jets in tow behind it.
I hear that a lot.
Now, I don't know, as far as bases are concerned, I don't know where the Air Force or the Navy would have flight hangars in around that area. I'm sure they are somewhere. But yeah, Michigan has got a pretty storied history of UFO sightings, and a lot of times the reports are of them over the lake.
Yeah, because in 2000, O'Hare International Airport reported that they saw 13 ghost planes on their radar. And there were no other planes in the sky, but the radar was picking up whatever it was.
And that's interesting you bring up O'Hare, because was it 2007 where they had that one that was over the tarmac for quite some time?
Yes.
And there were a ton of people that saw it. I actually spoke with a gentleman who was a pilot, and I asked him about it, and he was not there, but he did know one of the pilots that was there, and he said, this guy's a stand-up guy. He would not bullshit about something like this. And I don't believe he's the pilot that took the... There's a couple of pictures on the internet. They're not the easiest to find. But if you do see it, I mean, there is clearly some kind of a structured craft there. And I don't believe he was pilot that took the pictures, but he knew the pilot that took the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that was a very public event. There were people all around the area, not only at the airport, not even just the people on the concourse or that were out on the tarmac, but there were people who reported this sighting who were on streets on the outside borders of the airport as well. Pretty interesting stuff.
And it's great that pilots are finally coming forward saying, I saw this next to my plane, right?
Yeah, I mean,
people didn't talk about that stuff before.
Right, yeah. And in fact, when I had spoke with this pilot, I asked him, I said, he's like, you just don't talk about it. He's like, right. you will be grounded and you'll be doing mm-hmm. desk duty and probably lose your job. And I said, can you at least tell me, is there a protocol for if an event like this were to happen, is there a protocol for you guys as far as, you know, reporting it? He goes, yeah, you don't report it.
Right.
So, I mean, but things seem to be changing.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, people in the Army, boy, you say that, they're going to put you in the psych ward. You're done.
Yeah. But things seem to be changing now.
Yeah. Thank goodness. You
know, I know the Navy has rewritten their procedures as far as reporting on it. And it seems to be that there's not quite the crazy stigma being associated mm-hmm. with us now. So. Have we heard the last of what the government's going to be forthright about these things?
I'm sure they're not sharing.
I think we've heard just about all we're going to hear.
They just wanted to throw us a little cookie on the. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't see. I think they feel that they've given us enough. And mm-hmm. That's basically going to be it.
You know, talking about the UFOs, they are seen a lot around nuclear plants.
Yeah, you're very right. And I'm surprised that mm-hmm. I'm surprised that we don't, you know, because I'm not that far away from Palisades or Cook Nuclear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised that I don't hear much about that in this area, because you would think, even though they're not really, I guess mainstream media, local news and stuff like that, they'll always have, you know, their little minute and a half blurb of, you know, this was seen on whatever the situation was, but they still don't attack it from very much of a serious standpoint, I guess is what I'm getting at. But very rarely do you see anything, if ever, see anything about sightings around the Palisade or Cook Nuclear Center?
Well, and the nuclear plants don't talk about it. I'm sure they're seeing what's hanging around their facilities, you know. Like in 2019 at the Point Beach power plant in Two Creeks, Wisconsin, there was a UFO hovering over the facility, and a U.S. Marine, Miles Panosh, was just talking to his friend on the phone, and he's in his upstairs, and he looked out the window, and he saw this, and he's telling her, goes, oh my gosh, we're talking about this stuff, and there's something out there. So he got a hold of his friend who does video, and he says, hurry up, could you come over here and video this? So they were videoing it, and you saw in the book all the cool photos that this guy took, and this thing was visible from 8:45 to 11:30, hovering over the plant.
Wow! And which plant was this?
Point Beach in Two Creeks, Wisconsin.
Oh yeah, across the lake.
Yeah.
Interesting.
An ex-U.S. Marine, you know, he knows. But all kinds of craft that we have and everything, and he was legitimate. He goes, I don't know what that was.
Right. So what about Michigan as far as the disappearances? Do they all, you know, you were listing many from back way in the day. What about, you know, say from the 1940s, 1950s through now, you know, fairly current history, is it still seem to be as prevalent, the missing and unreported?
I don't hear much about ships and planes being missing anymore.
You know, I almost wonder.
Isn't that kind of strange?
Well, I almost wonder if, you know, and not to take anything away from the mystique of the triangle itself, but, you know, with advancements in technology and the
right.
the better sonars and radar and the GPS locations and stuff like that, I almost wonder if, you know, now that they have that better technology, if that's something that's helping getting from point A to point B without,
right,
you know, and with right, that, but, and with yeah. that, the, our ability to, look at weather patterns through satellite mm-hmm. and stuff like that probably has a lot to do with it as well.
You know, none of these ships could have any use of any kind of radar or any instruments that's going to tell them, oh, you shouldn't be in this place, or you shouldn't, you're talking the late 1800s. No, they didn't have anything
right,
like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it could be so easy you could run into a storm.
Yeah, now that doesn't explain away mysterious lights above the water. But
Well, and the guy missing from the ship.
That's very strange.
You know, or the ghost ships that they see.
Yeah.
They're not as strange.
Yeah, I was on Lake Erie, one of the other Great Lakes, and I honestly, and it wound up being weather conditions, just the refraction of light off the water, and you know the I don't want to say it was smog, but like the haziness of the sky and everything. I legitimately had seen a ship off in the distance that, man, I you know, it was eerie, and the way that it wasn't like fully solid, and it looked like it was slightly above the horizon of the water, you know, it just, man, for a good half hour, 40 minutes, I kept looking over at it, and it didn't seem to be moving. You know, it just seemed to be stationary. Well, we were actually drifting, so I think we were kind of moving in tandem with it. So our perspective pretty much stayed the same on this ship as when I first saw it. And eventually, sometime later, I kind of got tired of just looking at it. And I even took a couple of pictures of it. But it did get to the point where it had actually altered its course and turned a little bit. So once it did that, it was quite obviously an actual ship. But boy, there for about half hour, 40 minutes, I was like, man, is that a ghost ship? But yeah, it was, you know, when you're looking out across water and the way light hits and reflects off of it and the prism effect that can happen, and you know, whether there's low weather system in that area, and you know, if there's a lot of moisture in the air, it can do crazy stuff to what you're seeing out there. And I wouldn't say I was fully convinced, but boy, I was sure leaning that way when I was seeing that. And I still have a couple of photos of it that was my brush with what I thought was a ghost ship at first, but.
I remember the time I was on the shores of Lake Erie when I was investigating a submarine there. That's cool to investigate a submarine.
Yeah.
And
especially on inland lake.
Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what the name of it was. Oh, USS Silversides, I think. And I was out taking some pictures, and the waves were just beating on the rocks. The tide was coming, just beating on the rocks. It's like scary. So could you imagine being out on that water?
Yeah, that would, yeah. I tell you, you know, I've grown up on the water, and you know, on a small inland lake, I've been on a lake where it was, you know, looked like later on in the day the threat of rain or whatever. And boy, when that weather changes and it moves in, boy, that can happen in a heartbeat. And even mm-hmm. on a small inland lake, you know, you're gripping the sides of the boat pretty tight, and you know, saying, tossing a couple of prayers up that you make it. But on the big lakes, man.
Yeah, I mean, I got some really cool pictures of, you know, the waves slapping on the rocks, but I wouldn't want to be in the water.
All right.
That submarine was very haunted, too.
Was it really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were. It's weird. We were, there were just three of us that were down sitting at one of the little tables in there, in the bottom there, in the galley, and there's metal steps coming down, and we were trying to do an EVP session, and we heard somebody, you know, running down the stairs, and we go, what the heck? We're supposed to be alone here. Who the heck's coming down here? So we went to go see who it was, and two of us saw it. Legs were coming down the steps, just legs.
Oh, really?
And then it was gone. Yeah. I mean, you heard it. It was loud. But just legs from the knees down. Mm-hmm.
Were they see-through? I mean, obviously not.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Fully
yeah.
formed.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was just legs. And it was, you know, it was a military uniform.
No kidding.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to Alaska.
All right, Alaska.
This one is, you know, I mean, you can go on some of these streaming channels, and there's the Alaska Triangle and stuff like that, and you know, in the beginning, they say somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 people have gone missing in the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. Is that pretty factual?
Oh yes. Of course, you gotta remember there's 200,000 square miles of unexplored wilderness and mountains.
Right. Yeah, it's easy to get lost in there. Mm-hmm. You could,
animals can eat you.
You could disappear, no problem, mm-hmm. if that's what you wanted to do.
It's got 40 active volcanoes. There's all kinds of things.
So let's talk about that triangle. What's the What are the towns that I know? Juneau is one of the southern tips, and Juneau is kind of near and dear to my heart because the pseudo documentary, The Fourth Kind, about the abductions in Alaska, pretty much took place in Juneau,
mm-hmm.
and then. What, at the northern tip, Anchorage?
Right.
And I'm not quite sure where the other leg of it goes to. For me, a couple of things stand out about this triangle, and mm-hmm. it's a couple of experiences. One is the Japan airline, 1628, I believe, was the tail number. Flight number.
Yeah.
And that was a very, very well-known and deeply researched UFO sighting that apparently was massive in size. And then the other thing of interest for me is the reports of the Black Pyramid.
Yes.
Tell me what you know about those.
Well, you know, like I said, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere where most things are. Let me see where it says here. Got my notes. So was isn't during the 1950s, during the Cold War, the United States, they built a radar system up in Alaska called the Dew Line, or the District Earning Warning Line, so that it would give the military early warning of any Soviet nuclear strikes. And then a few years later, White Alice Communications was constructed there to work in conjunction. And they're like big microwave dishes, if you want to look at it that way, to get the signals. And then one day, it was in 1992, China conducted an underground nuclear test.
Oh, that's right. It was like 50 times the blast at Hiroshima. It was huge.
Yeah, and so afterwards, the United States started collecting seismic data in Alaska to make sure that, you know, when this went off, since they're so close, that nothing happened to our underground, did any kind of, you know, nuclear energy come over to, you know, to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And what they detected was minor electromagnetic interference, but they couldn't detect what the origin was. And then they thought, you know, what happened here? Does, you know, did China secretly come over and then do something underground there? Because remember, it's wilderness. So they says, all right, maybe they're trying to disrupt White Alice or the Dew Line. So they started do a lot more seismic readings, and, you know, and drew all kinds of measurements. And they found through the tests that there was some kind of underground structure. And as they did more testing, it appeared to be like an underground pyramid. So they named their project, code name, Dark Pyramid. Very secret, huh?
Hide in plain sight.
Is it? Yeah. Usually they have really cool code names, but that one. And they said it's 150 feet below the surface. And its points include Juneau in the southeast, the Barrow Mountain Range in the north, and Anchorage in the west. It's 1,150 feet tall, with each side measuring 1,510 feet, which is twice the size of the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt, which only measures 755 feet.
Now, I know Linda Moulton Howe,
yeah,
a very notable UFO researcher and journalist.
I would love to meet her someday.
She's something else. I know she's done a lot of work with talking about this story, and apparently has, you know, more than a handful of ex-military who are confirming that this thing exists.
Well, there was a counterintelligence warrant officer, his name was Doug Mocher, and he was stationed at Fort Richardson, and he was watching something on TV with other military members when this came on the news. And so the next day he went over to the news station, you know, to get a little detailed copy of the report in his hand, and the station just denied that they ever reported that, you know, that never came across the news.
So he watched it on the news, but then he wanted to go to the station and get confirmation and
get a hand copy. Yeah.
And then they told him that they had not aired it.
Yeah. So, you know, and he wasn't the only one watching. He was with other guys there. And so as he was leaving the station, one of the film editors told him that the station really did broadcast it, but he couldn't give him any more information. So he went back and he started going through government files trying to find out something. And one day he's searching files and he was approached by two officials who informed him that he had no authorization to be looking at the files, and they told him he had to leave. So then in 2012, he contacted Linda Moulton Howe and started telling her the story. And she broadcast an interview on Coast to Coast AM with him, mm-hmm. where he told her the whole story. So we still don't know what it is because it's a secret.
Right. Wasn't it not too long ago when several of our government officials went to Alaska along with one of our astronauts? Was it Buzz Aldrin?
Yeah.
And some other key diplomatic officials had gone to Alaska. And Buzz ended up making a comment that was kind of secretive and leading and not, I guess, maybe vague, but then like almost immediately had to leave the area because he had gotten sick. Maybe he wasn't very welcome there with what he had to say about it.
Oh, I wouldn't think so. Yeah.
So what other kind of weird things are going on up in Alaska with this triangle? Same thing with the, you know, 15,000 people missing in that area. And again, you know, it's a vast wilderness. It's not very inhabited throughout that area. People can tend to be, as you know, stupid and do things that put themselves in jeopardy. But that seems like an awful lot of people for just that area.
I think so. Well, another weird thing, like I think we have a lot of government connotations to a lot of disappearances up there. The Democratic House Majority Leader Hale Boggs of Louisiana and Alaska House of Representatives Nicholas and their pilot Don Jones boarded a twin engine plane, and they were taking a flight from Anchorage to Juneau to attend an election rally. It's supposed to take 3.5 hours. At 9:09, the pilot, weather conditions, and that was the last communication from the plane, and it never. So there was a major search looking for them. 39 days, they covered 325,000 miles, over 400 aircraft, dozens of boats, National Guard, no trace of the plane or the men were ever discovered.
Now, interesting.
Some people believe that there was a cover-up by J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI. Because in 1971, Hale Boggs served on the Warren Commission, and he accused the FBI of wiretapping congressional phones, and he called for J. Edgar Hoover's resignation. He also claimed that he knew why the wiretapping occurred, and his lawyers were going to go through the investigation. He was going to reveal his information to the public when he got back home. Mm-hmm. He also wanted to reopen the case of the JFK Kennedy assassination.
I'm glad you're getting to this.
Had JFK really been killed by our government because he was too close and was going to disclose what really happened at Roswell, New Mexico?
Well, I'll take that conspiracy one step further.
And, me too.
and say that because of John F. Kennedy Jr.'s or John F. Kennedy's relationship with Marilyn Monroe,
mm-hmm.
There are several that will say that Roswell information was exchanged between JFK and Marilyn Monroe. And that Marilyn was going to out that information. Was it Project Moondust?
Yeah.
So tell us what you knew about what you discovered about that.
Yeah. finally a declassified document of it, and they revealed that the alien UFO craft that crashed at Roswell, because he was at Area 51, he saw other debris, alien bodies. And so then, like you said, he was talking to Marilyn about this.
Pillow talk.
And so, yeah. And they had a wiretap on Marilyn Monroe's phone. And I actually put a copy of that in the book where you can see the wiretap. And they had obtained conversations of her with Robert Kennedy and journalist Jan of the New York Journal. And she made several phone calls to Robert complaining about the way she was being treated. Okay. After all their shenanigans ended. And she must see where she wanted to threaten to hold the press conference, releasing all these conversations that she was having with the two of them because she had it all recorded in her Diary of Secrets. And also in the document, they mentioned Project Moondust, which is actually the code name for a covert operation that would recover debris from spacecraft that had survived reentry from space to Earth. So she said she's going to go live tomorrow at a press conference and reveal all this. 36 hours later, she was discovered dead of an apparent drug overdose.
Yeah.
And after the assassination, Dorothy Kilgallen, the journalist, was so intrigued with organized crime, and she started probing into what she called a conspiracy. She, like we think, she held secret interviews and phone calls with those involved, such as Jack Ruby. And the following day, in October 1965, she was also discovered dead in her Manhattan apartment. Another suicide.
See a pattern forming here?
I'm telling you, this is just no coincidence. This was both suicide.
And even bringing into the equation the, let alone the governmental portion of it, but then you start bringing in the mob, mob connections to it too.
Yeah, because we're not really sure who they were after. Which one of the guys in the plane?
Yeah,
because some people think that Nicholas was actually the target. Because less than 17 months after his disappearance, his wife, Peggy, married Jerry Max Paisley, who she had been seeing secretly, and he was actually a hitman connected with the mafia. And so he was convicted of killing a man in a Tucson hotel. And he went to court. He realized he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison, and so he told the judge he wanted to come clean about other terrible murders he committed. And they go, okay. And they had no idea what he was going to talk about. And he says Peggy had given him lots of lavish gifts, and one of them she gave him, he was co-ownership in a bar. And one of the partners was the man he had given a suitcase to in 1972. And one day, while the two of them were having drinks, the man became drunk and told him that the suitcase contained a high-tech bomb, which he placed on Pan Alaska and 1812H, right before it left on its final flight. And he had no idea there was a bomb in there. And his only instructions were to take it to Anchorage, where he was to hand it over to two men. And after the exchange took place, one of the men told him, "Something big is about to happen." And another thing is, when the plane went down, even though they said they were searching, 2 days after the plane's disappearance, the Coast Guard in Long Beach, California, received a call from an anonymous caller claiming that he knew where the plane had crashed. And he forwarded the number to the FBI, who were supposed to interview him, but nothing came of it. And also a ham radio operator reported that he received a distress call. The FBI verified the coordinates, and they never sent a search party out there.
Never sent one.
And then 20 years later, a mysterious box was sent to a friend of the pilot. And inside the box were FBI classified files covering the two government officials and an account of a cover-up concerning a missing plane.
So admitted to a cover-up.
I'm sure. Yeah. So we're not really sure who they were after.
Sounds like everybody on that plane had had a target on their back.
Both guys, yeah. I mean, the guy he gave the briefcase to, you know, how did he know? Maybe he was a government guy.
What a web of intrigue.
That's one of my favorite stories about the Alaska Triangles.
So what else do you got for me? I asked you to bring one to the table that was of your choice.
Of my choice. Well, how about in Illinois, down the southern part of Illinois, it's called the St. Clair Triangle. And in January 2000, Melvin Noe went out to inspect his miniature golf course to make sure that none of the plumbing was frozen in his office. So then as he was coming out of there, he looked up and there was this huge craft in the sky 800 feet above him, almost the size of a football field, with blinking lights and everything. And so he, right away, he called the police to have him come, inspect something. So at 4:12 a.m., Officer Ed Barton went over, and he also observed a craft pivoting in the air without tilting to one side, and then it remained completely level, and it had multicolored lights. A little further away, at 4:23, Officer Dave Martin also saw the craft. He said it was a triangle shape, about 100 yards wide, and again, had all these blinking lights. And three brilliant lights projected downward onto the ground, and it had red and green flashing lights on the back. At 4:28, Officer Craig Stevens also saw a craft, and he said it was V-shaped, horizontal strobing lights. Everybody's seeing the same craft.
Yeah.
At 5:03, Officer Matt Janney also saw a triangular shape, totally silent, red glowing lights on the other side. So in the meantime, when this is going on, at 3:45 a.m., somebody contacted NIDS, the National Institute of Discovery. And so they sent somebody out to see what was going on, because supposedly this had been observed in seven counties, witnessed by lots of credible people. And it had actually traveled 62 miles in a southwest direction within 1 hour. So they came out, NIDS came out to interview everybody. They went to Scott Air Force Base. They went to Boeing in St. Louis, and they said, no, this was not us. We don't know what it was, but, you know, they all admitted it was something. And the Discovery Channel actually did a special on them called UFOs Over Illinois. And I wasn't living in Illinois at that time, so I missed that.
Oh, you lived in Illinois?
That's where I was born, yeah.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
You know, as far as these triangles are concerned, one of the, if not maybe the most consistent thing that happens with them, high traffic areas of UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the prevailing reports.
I know when I started writing the book, I just wanted to talk about, you know, mysterious places and things, and I had no idea it was going to go in this direction about UFOs. I did not plan that. But they all had the same common denominator. So I'm glad I went there.
Yeah, because obviously that's a subject that's near and dear to you. With some of your other research and being a card carrying member of MUFON. Has MUFON been a good resource for you as far as being able to look for documentation on these reports?
Yes, because I can actually go in to see people's sightings and, you know, pull up reports on it. And another good place to find information is, it's called The Vault.
Really? I don't know
if you ever heard of that.
No,
it's online. It's called The Vault.
And what is The Vault?
It's a guy that, he has his own personal website, and he has used the Freedom of Information Act to get all these government documents, thousands of them, and you can open them up and read them. And
interesting.
It is. I've been into a lot of files, and I said, "Wow, I love this." So I hope that the files I asked for, I hope they answer me and give me my files.
Through the Freedom of Information Act or through this,
yes.
The vault?
No, Freedom of Information. I didn't see my documents in his files.
Oh.
No. No, I have requested files from Bigelow, from Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah. Boy, I'd like to see those files.
I don't know what's going to be in the files. It might be nothing, but I want to see them anyway.
Any other highly unusual things? We touched on the O'Hare incidents in Illinois. What's the axis of the triangle in Illinois?
It's all the way down in the little tip where it's called Little Egypt Triangle, because like a lot of the towns around there have Egyptian names.
Well, that's odd.
Because when it was first founded, I forgot what religion the man was, and he was up on a mesa. He was down by Alton, and he looked down and he says, "Oh, this looks like the Promised Land." And so they named a lot of different. Yeah, that's where all these people. That's where all these cities got these names, because you're going, Little Egypt.
Yeah, seems like an odd thing for Illinois.
Well, not once that I read what he was talking about, you
right,
know, and it
yeah.
was, and they thought it was like, yeah, like the Mississippi was like the River Nile, and I mean, it just things he was saying, and yes, it's right by Alton, Illinois, which is a crazy place in itself.
How's that?
So a very haunted place. They had giant thunderbirds there.
Oh, really?
The home of Mineral Springs. You've probably seen that on TV many times.
Yeah.
I've investigated there a few times.
That's, have you?
Oh, yes. Very strange things. There was a Confederate prison there. I guess it was just called the Alton Prison, which was also on TV. That they tore it down after the Civil War, and all the cinder blocks, they took it and they used it as foundations in houses and stores. So like the whole town's haunted.
Oh.
With these cinder blocks from the prison.
Wow. What's your, I know this is getting a little off topic, but who cares?
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with Karen Tatro. Out from the East Coast, who's a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about haunted items and, you know, why does a spirit cling on to such odd inanimate objects? You know, what is the draw to that? Why do they do that? But you know, like in a situation like that, where it's a building where there was obviously a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, a lot of bad people, and you know, what's your thoughts on what makes those objects retain that spirit?
I don't think it has to come from a bad place. It could just be that this item belonged to the spirit and was really important to them.
But I guess,
you know, like a handheld mirror at a brush, just things like that that can be so haunted, but it was something important to them.
That I can understand, you know, a personal item like that. But I forget what they actually even made a TV movie about. A plane that crashed. I think Ernest Borgnine starred in it, where they took some of the wreckage from the plane crash and they were able to reuse it in other planes. And in those planes, people reported seeing the ghost of the captain from the plane that had crashed. Wow. You know, I can understand that, but when you're taking the cinder blocks from a building, you know, that seems to me that, I mean, I'm sure an inmate didn't focus on that one cinder block and say, oh, that's my cinder block.
No, but the conditions there were really, really bad. That's why they closed the prison down. It was just a really, really bad place. He probably just had all that bad emotional energy in those cinder blocks.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a person that's attached to it. It's the bad energy of what happened there.
Oh, I got you. So it's more of the energy as a whole versus a specific spirit.
Because there were no windows in that place. And in the winter, you know, it snowed into their cells. They were sitting in snow. It was really bad.
And how does one, you know, like if in from the standpoint of an investigator or somebody that has abilities like yourself that can help a spirit move along, how would one like yourself, how would you approach going into a home that was built reusing materials from this? Is there a way to I guess for lack of better words, exercise that energy from that, so the people aren't dealing with that? Or since there's no real spirit attached to it, are you kind of just screwed and have to deal with it?
I don't do any exercising of places, you know. I suppose you could, but I don't know. Maybe you could just, you know, and I hate to say sage, but just something to get rid of the energy, since it's not actually a spirit.
Yeah. Do you think that's a mistake that's made by people who claim hauntings and stuff like that? Do you think maybe there's more of these things are just energy versus actually being a spirit?
And it's residual energy, and it might not be a spirit there at all. It's just something that you're feeling. Like when I was in Mineral Springs, this was really weird. We were walking around, and we had a private investigation there, and we went down the basement and we started walking into this one room, and they actually used to slaughter pigs down there at one time. Okay, so I knew that. But I walked into this basement, had a dirt floor and everything, and my friend was next to me and he has abilities. And he stopped and he backed out of the room. Now, I've never seen him walk away from something, and I thought that was weird, but I didn't say anything. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing bodies all over, and they were natives, and there was blood everywhere, like there was a massacre. I'm going, oh my gosh. So I didn't say anything, and I went back out in the hallway, and he goes, I had to back away. I says, what'd you see? There were these two big braves, and they were standing shoulder to shoulder, and they looked at me. I thought they were going to charge me, so I left. So we both saw this. So I'm asking the owner what happened on this land before the building was here, because obviously this had nothing to do with the building. Oh, you saw blood when they used to slaughter pigs. I said, no, I saw people. And I've been trying to research. I want to know who lived on that land before the town was there. You know, could this be, it's probably residual energy that we saw.
Right.
But here it was in this building, which was never part of the building. And I don't believe there was, I mean, it didn't hurt us. It was just scary to see,
right?
To feel.
Can you differentiate between like that, which you saw, which you, you obviously knew it was not, they weren't coming after you. They were not interacting with you. Does it become fairly obvious really quick whether or not you're experiencing residual energy versus actual spirits?
To me, I can, yes. Or you'll say, somebody will say, oh, I see this shadow person in there. That's a good example. I see this shadow person. They're always walking in this doorway and they go down this way. That's, again, residual. It's not, that spirit's not really there. It's a little snippet in time that keeps playing over and over and over.
Yeah.
Like a memory of them, but it's not really there. You know, so you finally learn that after a while. There was a place that I used to investigate a lot, and I would see the same spirit walking down this way, and then it would disappear, and I finally realized, you know, no, there's not a spirit there.
With watching some of these shows, you know, ghost shows and haunting shows and stuff, you know, they lead the viewer to believe that specific types of stone, granite, areas that are near water, those kind of places tend to be more highly active as far as replaying residual energies like you're talking about. Have you found in your experience, is that true, or is that just kind of...
Well, supposedly limestone is a conductor. Yes, water. And I live by Fort Wayne in Detroit, and that's a very haunted location. And it's right on the Detroit River, so you have water. Everything built there was limestone, and it also used to be a Potawatomi Indian village. So you got all three there. Oh, and part of the Underground Railroad too. So I mean, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So I really think that because there's not just soldiers there. There's all kinds of different spirits, and some of it's residual, but some of it actually interacts with you. And I have EVPs. You know, they talk to you.
Do you think we all leave impressions that at some point could be picked up on, or is it more based on just traumatic things that have happened?
No, I believe we all do, and some, you know, sometimes somebody can go to a location and they'll be picking up something we said. We could be having a conversation at this place, and someone come back later and pick up an EVP of saying something.
I got you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, and I guess that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, because I did that one time. I was at a place, and I got an EVP that, and I've been to this place 6-7 times, and I got an EVP that just did not seem like it belonged to that place because it was very evil. And so I'm telling the owner, and I said, I don't know why I got this. This is disturbing. And I let him listen to it, and he goes, oh, I know what that was. And I said, what? We had a team come in here one time investigating, and they were shooting some kind of horror movie, and the one guy said exactly what you had recorded. Now that was bizarre.
Yeah.
And I says, okay, because I never heard any of the spirits say something I recorded that night. It was really bad. So yeah, I think we leave an imprint. I used to work in a store, and we were closing up at night, and before you close up, you gotta do a walkthrough to the store to make sure there's nobody inside hiding or still shopping or something. And so the one lady's back in the cash office. She's waiting for all the bags to come in. And I'm standing there, and there was an office upstairs. And I'm standing there waiting by the door with her, and I see somebody going up the stairs. I saw every one of the fingers go around the railing. They were wearing like a trench coat, but there was no head. And it went up the stairs, and I go, okay. I know I'm tired. It's Christmas. I've been working a lot of hours. I didn't see that. So we're back there a few days later, and I saw the same thing. I said, nope, that was there. But I can't tell anybody because nobody I work with knows that I talked to ghosts. So I didn't say anything, but it was like every time at the same time. So this was probably residual, but still was crazy. So one night, she's sitting in the office, and there was a mirror on the wall, and she's sitting facing the mirror, and so she could see out in the hallway. Uh-huh. And she jumped up, and she goes, I was in the cash office that night, and she was sitting at the desk, and she jumped up, and she goes, oh, my gosh, somebody just went up the stairs. And I blurted out, oh, you see him, too. I go, oops. And she said, you saw him? I said, how could I see him? I'm in the cash office. I said, but I've seen him before. And she goes, what? I says, it's the ghost. And I go, oh, you said the G word. Uh-oh. And I thought she's going to think I was crazy. And she says, what? And so she called the security guy. She goes, hurry, hurry, hurry. Somebody ran up the stairs just now. So Dave comes running. He goes running, stomping up the stairs. And he's looking around. And I'm following him. And I says, there's nobody up here. I says, it was the ghost. I said, you said the G word again. Now, they're both looking at me. And I thought, oh, here it goes. And they says, oh, we believe in that stuff. I said, oh, thank goodness. But, you know, who was? I says, well, you worked here a long, long time. I says, who do you think it was? She goes, I don't know. I says, okay. So then a few nights later, I'm working in one of my departments, and my departments were along the wall, and I swear I saw a shadowy figure walking around the perimeter, you know, like you're checking the store at night. And then somebody else was up by the checkouts waiting to get out with us, and she starts screaming, and I says, what? And she says, I just saw a guy walking down the aisle, all around the aisle, and then he went headed back to the office. And I says, oh my gosh, he does walk the whole store. And I kept saying, who is this guy? Tell us who this guy is. You must have some idea. He had to work here. He must be a manager that worked here. And so then the one woman says, oh, well, we did have a manager that worked here a long time ago, and he just got divorced, and he was really sad and everything, and one night he went out in the parking lot in his car and he shot himself in the head.
Oh my.
Explains why it had no head.
Wow.
But he wasn't really there. That was residual, but it was, I mean, watching his fingers grab the railing,
yeah,
that was so real. But yet it wasn't, because you could set your watch, same time, checked all the around the store, then went upstairs to the office just like we do every night. 10:15. He was always there, 10:15.
Could set your clock by it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But you hear that somebody doesn't have a head or his legs are missing, and that this could be why.
Yeah. You know, from the standpoint of somebody who's not very intelligent on this stuff, or have experienced that much of it, you would almost think that when a person passed, they would, if they were going to appear to you, they would appear whole again.
Right. Well, I don't think he was really there. I think that was residual, because if it's 10:15, if it happens every night at the same time, that's what you would call residual.
Yeah.
If I saw him during the day, then it might be, okay, maybe there's really somebody there. But, you know, if he was messing with the alarm, if he was moving stuff, but nothing like that ever happened.
Well, that was a great story to end with.
I'll never forget that.
Cheryl, I want to thank you so much for being with me again tonight. It's been a pleasure talking with you again. Hopefully our paths will cross this summer. It sounds like there's an awful lot of things going on in
the Bigfoot Conference.
Yeah, I've got mine that's going to be Bigfoot and Brews in Dowagiac, Michigan on September 10th. And then just announced yesterday for July 30th in Chelsea, Michigan, will be...
I just saw that one. I shared that one. I saw that.
Yeah, will be the Michigan Bigfoot Conference 2022. There's going to be a fairly good-sized group of Bigfooters who are going to be converging on the Manistee National Forest early June 3rd through 5th. Information on that is available on the Gumshoe Guy Facebook page. I've got the Ohio Bigfoot Conference coming up on April 30th, May 1st. Lots of stuff going on. So,
Michigan UFO contact up in Houghton Lake, September 23rd and 24th. That's always fun.
Oh, nice. You'll have to forward me the information on that. I'd like to see if I can make it to that.
That conference center is actually located on ley lines. It's very strange.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Your equipment will go crazy when you're there.
Bonkers, really?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully,
I mean, at first, I didn't know,
hopefully
I didn't
not
know
too
about
bad,
the ley line.
Because it's expensive equipment.
I didn't know about the ley line, and I was just having trouble standing straight when I was walking around that day. And I go, what the heck's wrong with you? And somebody else was saying that was happening to them. And I go, what is it? And they go, it's the ley line. I go, oh, the ley line.
Wow. Yeah, definitely get me the information for that.
Okay, sure.
And I'm actually thinking about maybe doing a coastline tour of some of the haunted lighthouses this summer around the lake.
So I've only been to the one in Port Huron.
I've been to Sechois Lighthouse. And while we were there, now granted, you know, it could have been just something they do, you know, to keep people coming in, but the reports there are the gentleman that used to be the caretaker of the lighthouse smoked a cigar, and I'll be darned if in two places, once in the main living quarters, I caught a whiff of a pretty strong aroma of a cigar. And then inside the actual lighthouse itself, about midway up to the top, I was again struck with the strong smell of a cigar. So thought maybe that might be a fun long weekend.
The one that I went to in Port Huron, that's very haunted. I've investigated inside there a few times. And it's believed that the lighthouse keeper is still working.
Oh, really?
Because I caught an EVP one time. I was start walking up the stairs, and I heard a man yell, "Who's coming here? Who are you?"
No kidding.
And we go, oh. So the guy's still working. Yeah, that's right on the Canadian border. You want to talk about rough waters there. Oh, my goodness.
Before we head out for the night, do me a favor and let everybody know where they can find you on Facebook, your website, and most importantly, where they can get a hold of your books.
I'm on Facebook, Cheryl Lynn Carter. I'm on Instagram. I think it's just Cheryl Carter on Instagram. I have a website, www.cheryllynncarter.com. You can get my books on Amazon. Or if you'd like a signed copy, you can just notify me on Facebook. I have lots of books here I can mail you.
That's how I got mine.
Yeah.
Cheryl, wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much for being on the show.
And thanks for having me again.
And hopefully we'll see each other throughout this summer.
I'm sure we will.
All right, dear. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
I want to hear your story. I want to hear your experience. So email me at contact.uncomfortable@gmail.com. If you enjoy the show, then leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Share the show with your friends. Share the show on social media. Make sure to like us on Facebook. And follow us on Instagram and Twitter, all at Uncomfortable Podcast. And until next week, my friends, stay uncomfortable.